scenes like that are all too common in Baghdad as angry Iraqis protest against the lack of progress in rebuilding their country. Before the war, the White House hoped U.S. forces would be welcomed with open arms. Instead, many of the arms they're seeing are guns. So what went wrong? Well, some say U.S. President George Bush should have seen it coming, that the current chaos should have been no surprise given the number of advance warnings. Here's senior correspondent Brian Stewart with our feature documentary, War and Recrimination.
Inside a tense White House through last fall and winter, President George Bush frets over countdown to war. On a March evening, the count is for real.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations.
First, shock and awe, then race to Baghdad. Bush expects to take over an intact state. Instead, his presidency is dragged into a draining struggle to repair and to pacify. There is a danger in journalism and history of relying too much on hindsight. Those too easy could have, should have been. But this is not one of those cases. For when I remember visits to Washington back over a period of 2 years before the Iraq War, what strikes me now are the memories of clear prior warnings. Those voices predicting chaos, infrastructure collapse, and guerrilla warfare. The Bush administration has been shaken by the aftermath, but we follow the trail of reports and Pentagon internal briefings over years that warned in stark detail of these very dangers. For a decade, the Pentagon planned for possible war with Iraq, but banners along its massive corridors marked the date when possible became probable, September 11th. Soon after that attack, planners dusted off O-Plan 1003, the long-established general war plan of Central Command for an Iraq attack. A version updated around 2000 by retiring commander General Anthony Zinni warned that 250,000 ground troops would be needed, as serious guerrilla war and social chaos would be anticipated. But this large force plan was ditched sometime last fall, to the alarm of Anthony Cordesman.
I mean, there is simply no reason to do anything this badly. But I mean,
Cordesman, a leading strategic analyst, warned Congress against a rush to war.
I think it is fairly clear that some of the planning that had been done originally in contemplating the plan to invade Iraq before this war was totally disregarded when we executed the actual combat plan. Under General Zinni and at USCENTCOM, there was a plan to deal with the problem of the pacification and security for Iraq, and there was at least a consideration that there would be insurgency campaigns after the United States overthrew Saddam. That seems to have been almost dropped from the planning activity for the war.
In the months preceding war, publicly, the Bush White House avoided hints of debate. But inside, powerful personalities clashed over Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell wanted to delay to plan more for the post-war and to build up a large UN-backed coalition. However, it seemed Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld regarded delay as defeatism. He argued fewer troops moving with dazzling speed would obliterate resistance without outside help.
The State Department was virtually frozen out of the effort, along with the other agencies of the U.S. government. And you went, in many ways, from a group of experts with regional background to a group of people with a highly ideological approach to the problem.
Rumsfeld's uncompromising view was decisively backed by Vice President Dick Cheney, who had close links with the Iraqi exiles. He argued Americans would be joyously greeted as liberators. Rumsfeld, now expecting Iraqi popular support, was more daring than his own generals. The ground troop attack was slashed from 250,000 to less than 150,000.
What Rumsfeld did was to say, look, if we take a few more risks, we can do it with far fewer people, we have the capability, we're going to do it this way.
Harlan Ullman holds a rarefied position among military strategists. In the 90s, he authored Shock and Awe, the new doctrine to use massive force to destroy an enemy's will. He largely praises Rumsfeld.
The war plan, I think, was gradually carved down to the point where we're going to go in with basically 2.5 or 3 divisions. And that was what finally was approved, and in terms of the military campaign, it worked brilliantly.
But Ullman also believes there wasn't sufficient preparation for the post-war.
I criticized this administration for failing to plan adequately for the peace. We should have consulted with many, many more people. And I think the administration has to live with that. I think we could have waited till the fall, and I think if we had an international coalition, we probably wouldn't have won the war any more quickly, but we would have had a better chance of dealing with the peace.
Most of the planning was done deep inside the third floor maze of the Pentagon by a small group of civilians under Doug Feith, an undersecretary for defense, the super secretive Office of Special Plans. Dana Priest, a writer on security and intelligence and senior Washington Post journalist, has delved deep into the Pentagon's inner structure.
That group, who many of whom I've interviewed, are people that share a view of the world that is not proving to be correct, but reinforce one another. And it's insular, so it didn't really advocate or allow different points of view that you might have gotten if you broadened the circle to include, for instance, military people who've done this sort of work before.
Like many Washington conservatives, Feith passionately believed the Iraq regime had to be defeated. His office worked in strictest secrecy because the U.S. did not want to alert United Nations members that even as Bush sought compromise, planning for post-war Iraq was underway. The secrecy is criticized today, but Feith is unapologetic.
It would have been better had the post-war planning office been set up 6 months or a year before it was. And for certain purposes, it would have been better. For other purposes, it would have been a big problem. The way we were planning, the profile of the planning, how visible it was, sent important signals. And we wanted to make sure that we focused the effort of the government and the world on trying to resolve the problem through the UN and the inspection process. And so the decision was made, let's not create a highly visible post-war planning office and suggest to the world that we were giving up on our diplomatic effort.
On top of the secrecy, there was some confusion. It was not until mid-January, barely 2 months before war, that retired General Jay Garner was brought in to head up the reconstruction team that would go into Iraq after the invasion. Garner had headed U.S. relief to Kurdish refugees in northern Iraq in the 90s. Still, he was not an Iraq expert and had little experience in nation building. Garner now concedes he was surprised by the chaotic nature of planning.
The problem is that there was no one person in charge, so that all those plans were done in a vertical stovepipe. They were very good. But what was missing was the horizontal connection of those plans.
Some now believe the Pentagon never saw Garner's role as key.
It was always seen as sort of a low-level humanitarian relief group, not as one that would have to deal with the major tasks of nation building at the political level, of constructing an Iraqi economy after 30 years of a failed dictatorship.
There seems to have been no major reconstruction plan even on the eve of war in March. Officials of the State Department and private agencies were alarmed that no one was listening to their warnings that security would be a major post-war problem. Joel Charney of Refugees International was just one who warned the government there would be civil chaos unless security was immediately imposed.
Our recommendation was, in the light of the potential chaos or anarchy that destruction would create, come with troops, come with military police who have a mandate to establish security, local level security, so that humanitarian operations would be able to go forward. What was demoralizing for us, and I might add demoralizing for the mid-level officials in the humanitarian side of the U.S. government, was just to see our collective opinions kind of ignored and bypassed and downplayed.
But voices of alarm were largely drowned out by optimists, particularly Ahmed Chalabi, head of the exile Iraqi National Congress. In Washington, Chalabi assured politicians that overthrowing Saddam Hussein and building a democracy would be relatively easy, as Americans would be joyously greeted as liberators. Many, including the CIA and State Department, distrusted the scenario as too rosy.
I think, quite frankly, that the Iraqi opposition, in terms of exiles, lived in its own fantasy world. Usually exiles do. They make all kinds of promises because these are the way they get outside intervention. They have to exaggerate their role, their ties to Iraq.
The strongest backer of Chalabi was Richard Perle, the famously hardline Reagan-era strategist who advised the Pentagon. He now denies over-euphoria.
You know, there are people who portray the expectations of the Department of Defense and others, the idea of rejoicing in the streets as if it was going to look like a Bruegel painting with the merry peasants. No one ever expected that.
What do you make of a statement you made back in December of 2001? And I quote, "If we are successful, and I believe we can be, there will be dancing in the
there will be dancing in the streets of Baghdad and throughout Iraq. We will be seen as
liberators of Iraq."
Well, I believe that there was widespread support for the liberation of Iraq by the Iraqis, and the evidence for that is overwhelming, including in the most recent polls. And the American forces in many parts of Iraq are greeted exactly as I suggested they would be. If you are going to report only on the problems in one part of the country, then you will get a very distorted view.
Perle is correct in that most Iraqis seem to welcome Saddam's fall. But the following breakdown in security and the collapse of services soon sparked widespread anger. War planners seem to have ignored not only security warnings, but scores of ominous pre-war reports that Iraq's whole infrastructure was near collapse after years of sanctions, especially the critical electrical grid.
There's no reason in the world that should be a surprise. I mean, there are countless reports available. There was a link because water supply and sewage was all powered by electricity. You know, the big concern was electricity gets knocked out, there's no clean water, there's no sewage, and you have an epidemic on your hands.
Though the electricity collapse crippled early efforts to repair Iraq, today Fife insists they could not have anticipated the grid's weakness.
Our intelligence was not fully informed about the really bad state of the Iraqi electrical and water and other key elements of infrastructure.
But some have expressed surprise that you were so surprised. Weren't there a lot of warnings, in fact, out there that the electrical grid was very feeble indeed?
Well, there were reports about certain aspects of the infrastructure problems. The intelligence that we had about both infrastructure and key institutions in the country, the police some of the ministries, was imperfect. And in some cases, what we found in Iraq was worse than what our intelligence community had assessed.
This seems the official line. Now listen to how Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, uses a remarkably similar explanation on CNN.
Well, we planned a great deal for a post-war operation. There were several things that people didn't foresee. I don't think anybody understood the true nature and true status of the Iraqi infrastructure. The devastation that Saddam Hussein wreaked on the infrastructure of Iraq is really extraordinary. Just as an example, you know, we've had difficulties with electricity and power supply. Well, it turns out that the country never had adequate power supply.
This denial of knowledge is hard to accept, for we know this senior military lecturer, Sam Gardner, took very detailed warnings before the war right to senior officers in the Pentagon and to Rice's National Security Council.
I showed them the impact on electrical power. Here's the plant, here's an individual in the plant. If this guy leaves, if you get a surge of power, this pump is going to break. Here's the electrical system, and here's where the grid's going to come down. Even if we don't target it, it's going to break, it's going to come down. Now, I don't know why she doesn't know. I talked to people who were one level removed for her, so, I mean, I find that disingenuous. She should have known. She could have known.
But if the administration knew Iraq's infrastructure would cost a staggering fortune to fix and endanger reconstruction, why wasn't that acknowledged beforehand? Gardner has one view.
If you wanted to bring it up to the standard of pre-1991, their UN number was $10 billion. You could have known that. And you could have said, if we want to be prepared for the war, we may have to spend $10 billion to fix the electrical system.
But why didn't they say that?
They were afraid of support. If they'd said it in October, November, or December, they might not have gotten support for the war.
When we come back, after Baghdad falls, more questions and growing criticism. When Americans arrived in Baghdad in April, their campaign seemed a masterstroke.
Hey, the fire's coming from the White Warehouse!
But very daring, as counting on surprise, they attacked early before the full force was ready. A virtual skeleton force, without many military police, was unready for the orgy of looting that swept city after city. It was anarchy so dangerous that even the chief administrator, Jay Gardner, couldn't enter Baghdad for two critical weeks.
I went to Tommy Franks on the 17th of April and said, "You got to get my organization into Baghdad." He said, "Jay, it's not permissive." He said, "There's still shooting going on." I said, "I know it is, but," I said, "I'm afraid there will be vacuums created. There are being vacuums created now, and I think it'll get filled up with things we don't want to get filled up with."
Gardner has since become one scapegoat for problems, but he arrived with few resources to face a meltdown of a modern society, infrastructure and all.
They went in the building, they stole everything, they stripped all the wiring out of the walls, they stripped all the plumbing out of the walls, and then they set everything on fire.
But I'm still puzzled why this was not anticipated or foreseen, this kind of general breakdown of law and order.
Tell me where else that happened. I mean, what was the base case for that? Give me an example. I mean, it's easy for people to Monday morning quarterback it, but like I said, we had prepared for some very intense scenarios.
But there clearly were lots of warnings, and the infrastructure, little damaged in fighting, collapses in the aftermath.
I can't stress enough the irony that in the actual military campaign, they protected civilian infrastructure, and in the aftermath of the campaign, they didn't protect the infrastructure. I mean, it's mind-blowing to see hospitals that survived the war be totally looted was difficult to accept and to understand.
Garner was replaced in May by Paul Bremer and is soon out of the picture. And yet, it is Bremer who committed one of the most controversial mistakes. He simply fired the Iraqi army, unleashing an angry new mass of unemployed.
History shows there's a few things more dangerous than mass unemployed soldiers.
We obviously did not consider well what was happening. There was no plan. You basically dispersed the whole army without trying to figure out where hundreds of thousands of young men would go. Let's forget about majors and officers. You literally had hundreds of thousands of young Iraqi men out on the street in a climate where there were no jobs.
Today, the Pentagon planner, Doug Feith, argues unrest has been exaggerated.
The kind of chaos that occurred in the immediate aftermath of the fall of Baghdad was really very limited in duration. I mean, it was a few weeks, and then it was over.
The problem here, though, isn't that those few weeks, in a way, undercut, to some degree, American credibility. I mean, it was a flashpoint, those 3 weeks.
I think that's overstated.
But finger-pointing and risk of failure is so severe, a frustrated Bush this week stripped the Pentagon of some of its responsibility for post-war reconstruction, giving the State Department more say. Feith is now called the ripest political target in Washington.
But does it bother you that voices of criticism are shooting their arrows in your direction?
Secretary Rumsfeld has this little book of sayings that he's put out called Rumsfeld's Rules, and I think one of the rules in there is if you're not being criticized, you're probably not doing anything.
But casting blame at civilian advisors may obscure the real issue, systemic problems inside Bush's inner circle. For reasons still unknown, Condoleezza Rice, who had Bush's ear and deep trust, seems to have played a curiously passive role.
One of the problems the Bush administration has faced is that Condoleezza Rice has chosen to use the National Security Council largely as an advisory body. Unfortunately, the U.S. government can no longer function that way. If you have strong cabinet members, unless the National Security Council advises the president and then implements a way of forcing coordination, it doesn't happen. And it clearly was not happening.
It was a White House responsibility to ensure proper planning.
I don't see how you can place blame anywhere except the president, because he makes these large decisions with the advice and counsel of his cabinet. And we're not talking about someone who withheld information. So I do think it will be a litmus test on Bush rather than on his advisors.
Bush's commitment to Iraq may ultimately succeed as earlier mistakes are corrected. For the moment, however, the public is showing some signs of growing dissatisfaction, as Iraq's recovery really does prove as difficult and painful as many had predicted. For The National, I'm Brian Stewart in Washington.